Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Buzz, this is Houston, F2, I'm at the 1/160th second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
Okay. I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the lamb now. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
As we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the first lunar landing, award-winning presidential historian and perennial New York Times bestselling author Douglas Brinkley takes a fresh look at the space program, President John F. Kennedy's inspiring challenge, and America's race to the moon in his new book, American Moonshot. The book is a portrait of the brilliant men and women who made this giant leap possible, the technology that enabled us to propel men beyond Earth's orbit to the moon and return them safely, and the geopolitical tensions that spurred Kennedy to commit himself fully to this audacious dream. American Moonshot is an homage to scientific ingenuity, human curiosity, and the boundless American spirit. And to talk about it all is Douglas Brinkley. Good Sunday morning to you, and welcome back to our show, Doug.
Well, good morning to you.
Nice job on Face the Nation last Sunday. You're big time, man.
Well, it was. It's fun to do. I used to be the historian for CBS News, and I once wrote a biography of Walter Cronkite. So I'm a favored son there at the network.
That's great. Oh, that's great. This book is, about space and the moon landing has been something in your blood since you were just a little kid.
Well, that's right. I grew up in near Toledo, Ohio, and my mom was an English teacher, and she just got just enthused about Apollo program. We watched all the launches on TV, and particularly Apollo 11, when Neil Armstrong went on the moon. It's an indelible moment seared in my mind because Armstrong was from Wapakoneta, Ohio, not far from where I was from. And so it really was like the hometown boy made good. Later in my career as a historian, I got to spend many hours with Neil Armstrong because I did the official oral history interview for NASA. And he had told me that, you know, the thing that people don't understand is when they got blasted off on that Saturn V rocket, they thought they had about a 50-50 chance of the mission being successful.
It's amazing to feel that way going up and knowing all those months leading up to it that, hey, this might not work out for me.
That's how brave these Apollo astronauts were. Of course, we lost three of them on Apollo 1, who in 1967, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee were incinerated in a rocket test at Cape Canaveral. So make no mistake about it, going to the moon was a risky venture. President Richard Nixon, 50 years ago, had written a letter talking about dead astronauts. It may have been a utter disaster, but instead it's an American triumph. And this summer, the whole country has been celebrating the American moonshot as one of the epic moments in our national history.
Well, it's a perfect perspective that you've put together, an American moonshot. Give us a high-level overview of really what the book is all about.
Well, you know, John F. Kennedy was born in 1917, and so he was the generation of the age of flight. It's hard to imagine before 1903, we never, no human being had really flown an airplane, and it got perfected during World War I. So by the time Kennedy's born, everybody's talking about flight and aviation. And just like in my years as a kid growing up, I focused on TV shows like The Jetson or Lost in Space,
sure.
Star Trek. Kennedy's childhood was all about Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and that someday America will go to the moon and Mars. And so that fact that it got that dream alive, Kennedy connected with Wernher von Braun, who had served as a Nazi rocketeer during World War II. Von Braun's the first one to put a projectile into space when he fired rockets in the crucible of the war for Germany that went over 62 miles, in breaking Earth's gravity grip. And we brought him over in Operation Paperclip. Von Braun didn't charge him with war crimes. And by 1950, he's in Huntsville, Alabama, which becomes Rocket City, USA, building Jupiter missiles, putting up satellites, and famously building the Saturn-class rockets that took us to the moon. That Saturn V was taller than the Statue of Liberty and could go 7 miles a second. Nobody ever imagined a rocket with that kind of power before.
And Kennedy was into this, I mean, as you said, for a very, very long time. You note, you know, for Kennedy, much dependent on the United States going to the moon, beating the Soviet Union, being first, winning the Cold War in the name of democracy and freedom, and planting the American flag on the lunar surface. But he was dead 5 weeks later after he was so passionate in a speech about getting there.
Well, that's correct. And the, the big impetus was from 1949, 1945 to 1949, the United States had a nuclear monopoly. But then the Russians got the A-bomb, and then the hydrogen bomb, and then they put up the world's first ICBM. Then they put up the first satellite with Sputnik, and then the first creature in space with the dog Laika, and then the first human in space with cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin. And Kennedy said, we're just going at best tit for tat, playing catch-up ball. And he would use the phrase in the White House, we've got to leapfrog the Soviets in space. We've got to do something big and dramatic. And he chose going to the moon on his famous May 25th, 1961 speech to Congress. And when he gave that speech, everybody at NASA, which had just been created in 1958, said, you got to be kidding me. We have zero technology to go to the moon. This is a moondoggle. This is a stunt. But Kennedy stayed with it and found bipartisan support. Was able to get $25 billion in congressional appropriations, which was a lot of money back then. And we started planning on how to get to the moon. And the reason we did it was to fulfill Kennedy's pledge to do it by the end of the decade. And on July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong accomplished that feat.
Now, you talk about his speech down in Florida, but he spoke at Rice University, where you're also a professor. And he said, while the eyes of the world now look into space, to the moon and to the planets beyond, and what we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom and peace, we have vowed that we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding. And that speech was with such great conviction, as you say. He made the speech in Houston. You know, Houston, we have a problem, Houston. There was a lot at stake down there, to make this happen.
Well, that's right. It was like a lottery. Who would get the manned space center in Houston won? And the city, our nation's fourth largest, is now synonymous with space. And so Kennedy came there on September 12, 1962, and gave what we call the choose to go to the moon speech, when he said, we choose to go to the moon not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And he did it in a football stadium of 35,000 people. And he talked about public discovery and the fact that the space was our new ocean, our new sea, that the Christopher Columbus's and Ferdinand Magellan's of today were the astronauts. And so it was a remarkable speech on about exploration and science, and it's evergreen. You can listen to it or watch it today and still be wowed by it. I think it was President Kennedy's best oratory performance. Many people quote from the Ask Not Inaugural, but there's nothing better than to re-listen to Kennedy's Moon Challenge speech.
Agree. Absolutely agree. And you mentioned, you know, he grew up with the Buck Rogers and the Flash Gordons. But in the 60s, I mean, all through the 60s, there was such a buildup to all this. But you think about all the things that were related to space, the Astros, the Rockets, you know, space-themed drive-ins, TV series, episodes about getting to the moon or Mars, like on the Twilight Zone. Major Nelson of I Dream of Jeannie was an astronaut. It was really all the rage, and I think Kennedy knew that. And he, you know, even though I believe he truly wanted to get to the moon, he knew all of this leading up to it would be must-see TV as well.
You know, that's an excellent point. I mean, just remember the Space Needle we see in Seattle today, that was built in 1962 for the Seattle World's Fair, which was all themed on space. Our country got the bug about space, and it was kind of the jet age. You could see it in architecture at airport terminals or, as you suggest, fast food records or hotels. The space was in vogue, and Kennedy rode the wave. A big part of what made things work was that in the late 1950s, Texas Instruments had perfected a computer chip that was small that NASA did applied science to, and NASA became an incubator in the 60s for new technologies as they tried to get astronauts to the moon. So things we take for granted today were, you know, GPS, telecommunications satellites, weather reconnaissance satellites, even the suits that firemen wear that's a bit fire resistant, or foam helmets that we use in football games, you know, kidney dialysis machines, CAT scan, MRI. I could just go on and on. We really earned the $25 billion worth in products that have helped American society. NASA was really quite innovative in the 1960s.
But Doug, you also talk about the myths that are out there that aren't true in some of this. Tang, Velcro, Teflon, those were myths.
Yeah, it's many of these products, just companies started advertising it. So, you know, the astronauts, Tang wasn't adopted by NASA. It just became an advertisement that Tang cleverly used. Velcro was used by the astronauts, for example, but it was invented during World War II by a Swiss alpine hiker whose dog would get burrs in its fur, and he found a way to take the burrs out of the fur using a Velcro, and NASA will later adopt it. So NASA didn't invent things like a Santa's workshop way. What they did was take existing products and mass produce and professionalize it.
Now, Kennedy was all in, but he had his critics as well, both in Congress and at home.
He did. And, former President Dwight Eisenhower said it was a big waste of money. And while Kennedy said it would cost $25 billion, Eisenhower said $40 billion. John F. Kennedy's own father, when Kennedy pledged going to the moon, his father went looking for his son, calling everybody in the White House and saying, you know, curse words, where's my son? I knew he would do something stupid like this.
Amazing. It's amazing.
You know, people in NASA just said, you just got to be kidding me. There's no technology to go to the moon. But Kennedy had an instinct that this would pull America together and that it was the right thing to do. And so as he's been celebrating the 50th anniversary, Kennedy is sort of a winner in the presidential sweepstakes because we accomplished what his dream was. And people like Neil Armstrong will always be American heroes. I mean, world heroes. 1,000 years from now, people will be talking about Armstrong being the first Earthling to break the shackles of planet Earth.
Yeah, you talk about Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Pete Conrad, Gene Cernan, the list goes on. And you talked about earlier that you spoke to Neil Armstrong, a mission that you had since you were a kid. That was something you always wanted to do. That must have been one of the most memorable and most historic conversations of your life.
It really was. You know, everybody has heroes from their childhood, and Armstrong was preeminent as mine, along with the baseball player Hank Aaron. And so, you know, when I got the opportunity to know Mr. Armstrong, spend some time it meant a great deal to me. So I'm glad to see the national appreciation of him. His spacesuit's been repaired and unveiled at the National Air and Space Museum. Wapakoneta, Ohio has a museum to honor his legacy. And school kids all over America learn his name in about the first grade. It doesn't get much better than that. Armstrong was a Purdue University engineer who loved aviation and was the right person to represent the United States to be that historic first human being on the lunar surface.
Talk to us a little bit about Buzz Aldrin. I know you talked to Buzz as well.
Buzz Aldrin is, you know, people think that he's sort of a pugilist, somebody who's tough and because he punched a photographer once. He's actually a very brilliant man. He ended up doing his doctorate at MIT in engineering, very smart and equally as talented as Armstrong. He did many of the great chores on the moon. And so they're a team. I would say Armstrong and Aldrin were like Meriwether Lewis and William Clark back in the core of discovery with Thomas Jefferson. These were two explorers that are always tied to the hip of history, and Buzz Aldrin is still alive and with us, as is Michael Collins. So it's been great for them to get to celebrate the 50th anniversary. I was on a program with Michael Collins at the Kennedy Library in Boston recently, and he's very clear that the next moonshot should be a Mars shot.
Yes, he has.
That we need to really go to the moon. And today, people that are, back, go to Mars, and today you can watch online our Mars rover, courtesy of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. But we're getting there. We're moving to Mars. People are, the technology is starting to aim at that planet.
I spoke to Buzz in an interview a few years back, and we're going to actually share part of that conversation during our history segment coming up next. But just a wonderful guy.
He really is a wonderful person. What great... all of the astronauts are great. You mentioned Pete Conrad. I recently gave a speech, and I did a Q&A in Washington, D.C., and in the audience was Pete Conrad's wife. And she said, "Do you realize my husband was the third human being on the moon?" And everybody forgets about him because it was a later mission. And so she's just incredible woman, and you just talk about now all the people that worked on the space program. Somewhere around 300,000-plus Americans took part in going to the moon. Companies like North American Aviation in California or Grumman in Long Island, McDonnell in St. Louis. It just goes on and on. And I'm getting letters and emails from people that are reading my book saying, did you know my uncle worked developing this part? And I had my grandfather, worked here. And there's just a lot of collective pride to just have been part of the Apollo program of the 1960s.
But bottom line, what Kennedy did during all this is he brought people together from both sides of the political aisle and across the country. And a lot of this happened even after he died, together on the issue for the need for exploration. And Johnson kind of, I didn't want to say exploited that, but he got these budgets passed and kept pushing it along to honor his President Kennedy's legacy.
And as I write about, one of the first things Jackie Kennedy did after her husband's death is go see Lyndon Johnson. And she had one request: I want you to keep Jack's moon dream alive. And LBJ said he would, and he did. He renamed Cape Canaveral the Kennedy Space Center. And on the martyred syndrome of the slain president in the 60s, NASA got 4.4% of our annual budget. Today, NASA gets a third of 1%. And they used to say at NASA, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. Space exploration was expensive and is expensive. So if we want to do something like go to Mars, we either have to pony up and pay for it or collaborate with other countries in the world and make it a joint national endeavor.
You were talking about Walter Cronkite. He was at the forefront of some of the most historic moments of our time, of course. The space race was no exception.
Well, he was. And he was like, we used to have the Mercury 7 astronauts, and they used to call him the 8th astronaut. in the late 1950s and early 60s. He was the original fanboy of going to the moon. He would read every book and every memo, everything about NASA and space. Part of it was because he had grown up in Houston, Texas, and himself, that was his home. And then he, during World War II, he was a writer for the United Press covering military aviation in Europe. So he really befriended many pilots and who later worked for the U.S. Air Force after the war. He had the perfect and ideal Rolodex of anybody and everybody involved with space exploration and science. And so it's just one of the great legacies of that unbelievable broadcaster who's very missed. People all the time say, what happened to Walter Cronkite? I wish we had one of those, one of them now.
Sure, absolutely. And there's so many other great stories in this book. Absolutely enjoyed it, Doug, as always. The new book is American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. The author is Douglas Brinkley. Thanks again, my friend, and enjoy your Sunday.
Hey, thank you so much.
Thanks, Doug. All right, this is history, including excerpts of my conversation with American legend Buzz Aldrin after the news next on 720 WGN.